This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel like
Kobayashi Issa is one of Japan's best-loved literary masters, with over 20,000 haiku poems to his name. Issa was a devout Buddhist, and like the founder of Buddhism before him, Siddhartha Gautama, Issa was well acquainted with the suffering of the world. He lost his mother when he was a child. He was cruelly treated by his stepmother, lost four of his own children in infancy, and then watched his own wife die during childbirth. In just one of Issa's poems, he addresses the tension he felt between being devoted to the teaching of the Buddha and the reality of his acute sense of loss throughout life. As a Buddhist, he had been trained to think of all earthly circumstances as dew, a watery, momentary substance of no lasting significance. As I've said several times in this series, Buddhism insists that if you are able to remove your desire for the things of this world, adopting a stance of passivity toward the pleasures and pains of life, then suffering will evaporate like dew in the daylight sun. It's with this doctrine in mind, at the death of one of his baby girls, that Issa penned these few anguished haiku lines. This world of dew is only a world of dew, and yet. Issa could not bring himself fully to embrace the idea that life and death are dew, and that the anguish he felt over the loss of a child was a weakness born of an illusion. And so he protests ever so mildly, and yet. Now, I raise the example of Kobayashi Issa not at all to call Buddhism into question this morning, but to highlight one of the great differences between the Buddhist and biblical perspectives on suffering. I've mentioned many times in this series already that the Bible invites us to bring our anguish to God. The words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me, enshrine forever the reality of human pain. Biblical believers make terrible Buddhists. But I want to today extend that idea, at first seem a rather strange idea, to say in categorical terms that the God of the Bible would himself completely fail of the Buddha. Passivity in the face of suffering and immunity to the experience of pain are concepts utterly foreign portrait of God revealed in the Bible. And here we arrive at what I consider a precious aspect of the Bible's about suffering. I do value the material we looked at last week, the Bible's explanation of both human evil and physical disorder is for me, for the most part, intellectually satisfying. Moreover, the Bible's pledge that God will one day judge the tyrannies of the world and restore the creation itself is for me, for the most part, morally satisfying. Nevertheless, there is an aspect of the Bible's teaching on suffering that I regard as more important than these theological responses. It has to do with the kind of God the Bible urges us to approach with our pain. In particular, it has to do with the unique and bizarre affirmation that God Himself knows pain. Just think of the Bible's plot line for a moment. It reads like a tragedy. The Creator designs a world for independent relationship with Him. Human beings take that independence, transform it into autonomy, and say no to God consistently. God sends prophet after prophet, pleading people return to Him. The prophets are refused and rejected. Finally, God Himself enters our world in the person of Jesus Christ, God in flesh, the Bible says, only to be resisted, rejected, insulted, and ultimately tortured and crucified by the very people He came to save. The anguish of God in the person of Jesus, I think, is captured well in a brief line in Luke 19:41. As Jesus approaches Jerusalem 1 week before His execution, after 3 years of teaching and healing and pleading with people to return to God, we read these words. As He approached Jerusalem and saw the city, He wept over it. God in flesh, weeping over those who rejected Him. Well, this biblical portrait of the heartbroken, wounded God is seen nowhere more clearly than in the crucifixion scene just read to us from Mark's Gospel. There, the circumstances and cry of the anguished poet of our much-quoted Psalm 22 become the circumstances and cry of Jesus Himself. It's quite extraordinary when you line up Psalm 22 against Mark 15. The poet had been the object of ridicule and mockery. In the words of verse 7 of Psalm 22, all who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. In the same way, we read in Mark 15, the chief priests and teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, but he can't save himself. The poet's very garments had been seized by his attackers, according to Psalm 22:18. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. The soldiers at the foot of the cross did precisely the same thing to Jesus. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. Just as the poet of Psalm 22 could state metaphorically in verse 16, they have pierced my hands and my feet. So Jesus experienced real nails driven through real hands and feet. In the words of verse 24 of Mark 15, they crucified him. It seems that Mark has deliberately worded his account of Jesus' death to recall this famous ancient poem of suffering. Which is not to say that Mark made stuff up. Gambling for the clothes of a vanquished foe, for instance, was a very common ancient practice, very likely to have occurred at many public executions, including that of Jesus. First, believers perceived in the events of Jesus' crucifixion an uncanny connection with the lyrics of a poem that had been sung in Jewish synagogue services for centuries. More than that, Jesus' actual cry from the cross made that connection explicit. In the final moments of Jesus' life, as blood loss sapped his strength, and asphyxiation stole his breath. He reached out for words that would convey to the crowd his innermost feelings. He chose the opening line of the famous Psalm 22. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, quoting Psalm 22, verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now let me make something very clear. These words are not a cry of self-doubt from Jesus' lips, as if he were here questioning his identity as the embodiment of God, or questioning his mission as the saviour of the world. His words, chosen carefully, are a deliberate and agonizing identification with the suffering of the famous poet of Psalm 22, and therefore with anyone who has ever felt like crying out, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" There on the cross, God in flesh intentionally enters into the pain and misery of the world, getting his hands dirty and bloody. This is God at his most wounded, and yet at his most glorious. But of course, not everyone agrees with that. I once spoke at the University of Western Sydney on this very theme. And after the talk, the chairperson asked the audience if there were any questions. A man in perhaps his 30s, very politely spoken, stood up and proceeded to tell the audience, not really me, I was irrelevant, how preposterous was the claim that the creator of the universe should subject himself to the realities of this creation. That he would have to eat and sleep and go to the toilet, he said, let alone die on a cross. The man was a Muslim leader in the university and an academic, which was just my luck. When the MC invited me to respond, I did my best to react to his central concerns. We went to and fro in public for about another 10 minutes. He insisted that the notion of God having wounds, whether physical or emotional, is not only illogical, since the Lord of all things could not possibly be caused pain by a lesser entity of creation. It was also an outright blasphemy, he said. And statements in the Quran call this teaching a blasphemy. Surah 519, 75, 76, and 78, in case you're interested. Now, I had no knockdown argument for this guy. I didn't even have a witty response. But I did thank him for demonstrating for the audience how different are the conceptions of God in Islam and in Christianity. What the Muslim denounces as blasphemy and what the Buddhist says is unenlightened is for the Christian precious. God himself knows pain. This God is able to comfort those who suffer, not simply because he is all-knowing, an attribute you would ascribe to any deity, but because he knows suffering firsthand. This point is captured beautifully in a poem called Jesus of the Scars, written by Edward Shillitoe after his own life was shattered after First World War. He wrote these, I think, beautiful words. "The other gods strong, but weak. They rode, thou didst stumble to a throne. But to our wounds, only God's wounds can speak. And not a God has wounds, but thou alone." I want to close this series on a more personal note than I usually think is appropriate in a sermon. The most painful effects of losing my father were felt not when I was 9 at the time of the plane crash, but years later when I was about 18 years of age. This was a time when I began to see my best friends become mates with their dads, turning that emotional corner where dad is transformed suddenly from the local policeman into someone to confide in and look up to. I watched that happen, and I remember one night in particular on the balcony at Ben Shaw's place. Ben and I were just out on the balcony chatting about stuff when Ben's dad, Art, came out with 3 beers. Now, it was not the first beer Ben and I had had, and Art knew that. But this was different. This was a deliberate father-son moment, a way of saying to Ben and to me, "Now we drink beer together," which back then was a big deal. Now, Art included me in this little ritual. I think he was always conscious of me in that way. But for me, it didn't work. I stood there thinking, "Art, you're not my dad. I'm not your son." And suddenly I began to feel a whole new set of doubts and resentments. The question when I was 9 was, "Mum, why did God let Dad's plane crash?" The issues at 18 were very, very different. I'd come to accept the claims of Christ when I was in high school. So now my confusion was not so much how could this happen, but where is my God in my moment of need? What do you, God, know of my suffering? I'll be honest with you and say, for about 6 months when I was around 18 years of age, I stood on the edge of Christianity, wondering if I wanted to remain committed to the passive, distant God of my imagination. But I thank God that a friend took me aside quietly and said to me something that would change my perspective on suffering forever. She said something like, "John, it's okay to feel what you feel, to doubt what you doubt, to question in the way you're questioning, but you must do it looking at the cross." And suddenly, I realized the most extraordinary contribution of the Bible to the problem of pain. The true God is neither passive nor distant. He is involved and himself wounded. This God, and this God alone, can relate to and bring comfort to those who suffer. As Edward Shillitoe wrote, "To our wounds, only God's wounds can speak, and not a God has wounds, but Christ alone." I still have intellectual questions about the problem of evil and suffering. I'm not bold enough to think I've answered all your questions over these last few weeks. But in the end, what the Christian gospel offers is not only the least incomplete answer for those who ask questions about suffering, but also the deepest source of comfort for those who bear the wounds of suffering. In the great work of art we call the universe, we can't always follow the artist's handiwork. Some of his work just baffles us. But what the biblical narrative tells us, and what the passion narrative of Christ in particular tells us, is that while I may not always be able to trace the artist's hand, I can always trust his intentions. For the God who is master of all things and who will one day restore all things is also the God who knows the suffering we know. This is the God I am allowed to question. This is the God I can find comfort in. His heart, if not all his ways, is clear to us because on the cross he wore it on his sleeve for us all to see.